After hanging up, he holds onto the phone, other hand flat on his chest, over pictures of Harold and Tony. After those two died, he was distraught, couldn't speak their names for a couple of years. Nowadays, he studies their photos at length. They make him laugh. So fast gone, isn't it? Was I anything? What anguishes him most is not that he didn't succeed, but that he didn't experience more. Other lovers, intrepid trips, peculiar foods, a daughter and a son, both grown, returning to see me. How nice you could come. Sorry I'm not at my best. Take a seat. There's a space on the edge of the mattress. Tell me, what have you been up to of late? When young, Pinch considered human connections the refuge of those who couldn't make art. Or is art just the refuge of those who cannot connect? Work colleagues drop by, including Francesca, who brings a stack of grammar books, knowing they'll divert him. A brand new Italian, German, French, Portuguese texts, all pilfered from the school. Courtesy of Uncle Utz, she says. He reaches for his notepad, writing, Molto gentile, grazie. Nearly without exception, the colleagues who visit are women. The male teachers can never make it, which hurts him, although he never lets on. He always replies cheerfully to their text messages. One man who does appear is Marsden, turning up alongside a diminutive companion with tweezed eyebrows and carefully trimmed beard, as groomed as a French formal garden. Privately, Pinch thinks of Rob as Marsden's sidekick, but doesn't use that term, knowing it sounds dismissive. As it happens, he immediately warmed to Rob, who has sensitive grey eyes and, despite his size, is always in everyone's way, apologizing excessively. So sorry. Only for another person to tap him on the shoulder, setting him off again like a well-dressed pinball. Marsden and Rob flew in for the week to help Pinch with his return from the hospital. They make an excellent team, supplying all Pinch's favorite treats, not least plentiful Maltesers. Rob compiles a list of vegetables that are supposedly cancer-fighting and discreetly adds them to Pinch's diet. They place flowers around the bedroom and bring out his favorite art books. Each day they interrogate Pinch on any desired comforts, and no matter how obscure, track them down, always in the most lavish version. When he can't eat, they consume his favorite meals in front of him, which is heavenly for Pinch. I just realized something incredible, Marsden, Pinch kids. You were the love of my life. Did you realize? You even sent me bouquets in secret. Me? I never. Everyone laughs. In medicated delirium, Pinch can be extravagant. But he is at ease around them and speaks as himself. Among the worst aspects of illness, with ample competition, is the incessant talk of illness. Instead, they discuss music and films and old days in Toronto. When their departure approaches, Marsden and Rob announce their intention to stay on. They're clearly needed here. But Pinch declines. Ching is worse at caring for him, but she is in tatters over his current state, and suffers when she finds nothing to do. Tensely, Marsden packs, repeating aloud everything they must do before the taxi arrives. Rob bids farewell and waits downstairs. Marsden and Pinch are left alone. I have to let go of my hand at some point. You mean it doesn't come off? It's become quite attached to me. I feel the same way. 82. When Pinch asks Birdie if she had a comfy flight, she can't remember. It's too shocking to see her brother like this. Throughout her 4-day visit, she avoids him, finding things to go out for, rushing to the kitchen at any opportunity to wash dishes or clean the fridge shelves, anything. On her final afternoon, he forces a conversation. He wants to settle a few things, needs to apologize for not having stood up for her when she visited Rome, for trying to be Dad's favorite. But when he approaches any subject, she keeps interrupting, not allowing this to be the last conversation. It's not the last anything. Not sure when I'll die, Bird, but I'm certain it'll be this that kills me. She changes the subject, talking of when she picked up her new little brother at the international school in Rome, eating ice creams in those gorgeous piazzas, little Charlie translating her flirts with Italian boys. What funny times, he says. I love how you maintain such high spirits, Charlie. Because this conversation is for you, Bird. I won't be here to remember it, and I need to get this in your memory in the right way. Oh, cut that out. You ain't going nowhere. She hurries on to a discussion of the Faces show in New York. How great that was, she marvels. Our dad. 83. When Barrows hears about Pinch's sickness from Marsden, she emails Pinch immediately. I'm doing a talk at the LSE in a few weeks. Could I see you? He hesitates. I'm so hideous now. Who cares? I do. As her visit nears, Pinch reads the alarm in people's eyes. Oh, stop fretting about how everybody sees you. He recalls his excitement of younger years when meeting with Barrows. I've missed her. Missed a lifetime in her company. They must have a long talk when she comes. But he sounds moronic. Well, she can talk. That'll suffice. Suddenly he needs Barrows to know. She, whose opinion matters more to him than anyone's. He needs her to know that she adores an artist, and it's me. Barrows sends increasingly detailed messages. I'm about to leave New York. Just arrived in London. Checking into the hotel. We'll be at your place around midday before the conference opens. So looking forward. By email, he explains how to find Ching's house, sending instructions 3 times. We can have lunch and talk. I might have to just listen sometimes. On that day, Ching goes to her office to leave Pinch and his friend in private. An hour before Barrows arrives, he props himself up in bed, bravely refraining from painkillers to keep his mind clear. As arranged, the front door is left unlocked, so she can let herself in. When I tell her about the painting, she'll see that I achieved something with my life. Even now, he thinks, shaking his head, even now I need to impress Barrows. Hello? Here. Up here, he calls out, cringing at his slobbery voice. Clomp, clomp, up the stairs. Hey, it's you, he says, chest tightening. Yes, yes, that is Barrows. Hair still long, entirely grey now. She doesn't dye, and good for her. Natural. Dignified. Forgive the sight of me, he tells her. I look like a ghoul. It's the chemo. Does it to everyone when you're on this dose? Untrue. They stopped his chemo weeks ago. As you keep the lights low so nobody has to see. You look fine, Charles. Fine is one thing that I do not look, but thank you. She pulls up a chair. He asks her to speak of her conference, which relieves him of talking for a while and allows him to muster saliva. He scarcely hears. So preoccupied is he with this imminent confession. He'll go over everything, explain what he did, how, and why. Speaking of her own work, she is distant, pleased with herself. Was she always like this? Barrows keeps diverting back to the subject of Bear. I was thinking of our crazy trip to France, she says. At the time, did you realize why I was going there? I think you did, right? My big notion of writing something about him. About my father? No, I wasn't aware. Didn't you sort of bring me for that reason? She responds, an arch smile. To show off your famous father? Did I? Maybe. Anyway, I never got enough material because of that argument. What was our argument even about? He wonders, aiming to shift to warmer matters. About you being obnoxious, if you don't mind me saying. Oh, he responds, taken aback. Yes, it probably was. Anyway, I'm sorry to hear that. Actually, he adds, interrupting her, I'm very sorry to do this, Barrows, but could you possibly go? Are you not feeling well? Very much not, but that's the norm. I don't mean to be rude, and I know I am, but it's a matter of urgency. I'd quite like to be alone, and my time is limited these days. Sorry, I shouldn't be doing this. She rises, gathers her belongings. I travelled quite a way to get here. No, you're right. I apologize. He looks directly at her. She leans down, a kiss on his cheek. I wish you such good luck, Barrows. That night, Ching asks how it went with his friend. Quite well. And he means it. Pinch isn't downcast about the meeting. He's relieved, because Barrows was not the person he imagined. Anyway, not that person to him. Not anymore. 84. Ching enters his bedroom. Pinch reaches out, eyes shut, seeking her hand. He urges her to sit on his bed and describe his dogs. As her words reverberate, he drifts into fevered sleep. Phones are ringing, the house bustling with policemen. He wakes, inhaling turpentine, smelling Bear's clothing. He sniffs again, the dust of Natalie's clay, dirty doorknobs, her grey fingertips. How amazing my mother and father were. All those years, all their bullying doubts, all in the paltry hope that strangers might some day stand before their work and look, probably no longer than a few seconds. That's all they were fighting for. What driven lives. And his own life? Viewed at any point along the way, it seemed to Pinch to have so little direction. But from this present vantage, what happened feels inevitable. Not because events were beyond his control, but because they were within it. He couldn't have been other than he was. That doesn't hurt any more. Just another ant, marching up and down. Or is this the painkiller talking? He smiles in the dark, unsure if the thin light framing his curtain means almost morning, or nearly night. He recalls a conversation with Natalie, when, in sullen adolescence, he read her a line of German philosophy that claimed evil outweighs good by a comparison of the respective feelings of two animals, one of which is eating the other. Natalie recoiled. That, she retorted, overlooks so much. Sensory experience, change, ideas, and a few allies. How few, all of which combine into more than the waiting darkness. Don't you think, Pinchy? I bought you a leaf, Ching says, placing it on the bedspread. He opens his eyes, takes it by the stem. Lepidopterist, he says. What language is that? Just a language in my head. Noticing Pinch's eyes flutter closed, she tiptoes away. I have a question, he says, or believes that he says. Why is that leaf so beautiful? Why does one thing contain beauty and another doesn't?
The park, it overwhelms me.
He says park, but means back garden.
Almost makes me cry to look out that window. But those concrete flats over the fence actually make me furious. Not that nature is better than artifice, because art is artifice. Sorry, what was the question?
The question is, why should a leaf be beautiful?
Well, because it has healthful associations, or because within our primal selves you associate color with plenty. Might that be it? But why find beauty in a painting, and how can an abstract be so affecting?
Or a piece of pottery, for that matter, he adds. Silence interrupts him. It holds. He yearns for beauty. More. The art books around him, doesn't care to view them. Lately he finds the sublime in unpretty faces. He could watch them for years. Natalie was right. Life is thrilling.
Must get to the cottage. Must.
Charles Bavinsky outlives his father by little more than a decade. Portrait of an Artist. Hand-built, abstract ceramic. Splashed blue and red glazes, incised lines. 16 by 9 by 6 inches. Courtesy of Chao Qingfei. 2011. 85. Upon learning of Pinch's death, his siblings contact the Petros Gallery. They know their brother's plan was to bequeath the faces to museums. Can that be cancelled? Everything depends on Pinch's estate. His sole beneficiary is someone named Chao Qingfei. Wait, what? This must be a mistake. It turns out to be the woman in whose house Pinch lodged during his final years. Was this some sleazy affair? Did she manipulate their half-brother when he was sick? In any case, this is an outrage. A stranger controls their legacy. Complicating matters, tax officials are meddling, with the French, the Americans, and the British all making claims to the inheritance. And one big question hovers over everything. Are there more paintings? A lawyer counsels Ching to immediately conduct an inventory at the cottage where the deceased apparently stored his father's art. If she finds nothing, fine. But if she gets lucky? You realize how much a Bavinsky goes for these days. Ching refrains from answering, or admitting that she has no idea where Pinch's cottage is. She does own a set of scratched old keys, however, and considers asking Birdie for the address. Perhaps that sister is allied with hostile family members. Instead, Ching approaches another of Pinch's final visitors, Marsden, who mentioned living at the cottage for a spell. You can come and show me? She asks by phone. I pay for your flight, okay? They meet at an airport outside Barcelona and drive north into French Catalonia. Marsden's transatlantic haze is intensified by the strangeness of returning here. He attempts to converse with her, but most exchanges falter. "Interesting," he says, "how Charles studied grammar right till the end." Charles liked preparing. But what for, at that point? It's good to study. They drive up the mountain in silence, united by someone who doesn't exist. "It's scary to think what we might find," he remarks, looking at her. Gripping the wheel, she slows into another hairpin turn. 86. He guides Ching around her own property, pointing to the art studio and the woods behind. In the cottage kitchen, dead flies dot the tile floor. The shelves are stacked with domestic pottery, stamped on the underside with the hallmark C.D. Upstairs, the bed is made, linen humid, whiffs of potpourri. Entering each room, they flick on the lights with anticipation, as if someone might lie there, sit up and stare at them. On the bookcases are battered thrillers, guides to the Roussillon in English, and a notepad so old that when Ching takes it from the shelf, pages flutter to the floor. It once belonged to Cecil Ditchley, and contains glaze formulas and elegant cursive, of the kind that nobody can produce anymore. They also find a copy of the Bavinsky Memorial Booklet, along with Pinch's bound thesis on Caravaggio, with Bear's notes jotted in the margins, even though he always claimed never to have read more than a few words. He recalls staggering up the stairs of that shared home in Toronto, Pinch frowning at his desk at this housemate with a bottle of booze in hand. That isn't a happy memory, for they were growing apart. The indolent and the industrious cannot stay friends. But such distinctions are trivial now. Their affinity on the steps of the Sydney Smith Lecture Hall proved truer than any rupture. Marsden rests the Caravaggio thesis on his palm. He has never read this. Marsden flips open the thesis, stopping at the dedication. "To the two great artists of my time, Natalie and Bear." Marsden smiles. He slides the copy into his bag, calling out, "No paintings over here, but don't abandon hope. We still have the studio to check." They walk out into a drizzle, quick-stepping up the soggy turf. Ching fiddles with the two locks on the studio door. Inside, she flicks the light switch, but they remain in darkness. She turns on her smartphone flashlight, its beam picking out matted brushes, twisted metal paint tubes, a table splodged with hardened slugs of color. But there is no art, except an unfinished picture on an easel. A face shown overly close, viewed at invasive proximity, forcing its subject, a youth, to turn away, as if edging off the side of the canvas. "That could be worth something," Marsden says. They can't risk carrying it back to the cottage through the rain, so leave it for now, locking the studio. "Well, that's pretty much everything," Marsden concludes. "There's a storage space in the attic, but it's junk up there. Old boxes of his mother's pottery. Nothing of value." The low clearance in the attic forces them onto their hands and knees. A phone light illuminates dusty cardboard boxes of ceramics, many in tissue paper, a few cracked. Marsden unwraps a long-necked vase, reads the bottom, signed in the clay, "Natalie." He shows Ching. "Lovely, don't you think? Is that glaze blue or green? So dark up here." "Gosh, there's tons of pots. Not sure what you'll want to do with them all." She angles her light above the boxes. "It's rafters that way," he explains. But the sweep of her beam halts. "Holy shit," he says. It's so cramped that they cannot reach the other side without first removing all of Natalie's pottery. Marsden is touched by how gently Ching treats it, lifting pots from the disintegrating boxes, cradling each piece down the stairs, notwithstanding their shared impatience. "Nearly there." They approach the rafters, raise the tarpaulin. Stacks of paintings. "Oh my God." "Let's bring them down first," Ching says, maintaining outward cool, but stiff with tension. With utmost caution, they transport each canvas into the kitchen. Marsden, leg jiggling, counts them. 26 here. All life stills. "This is insane, Ching." With her permission, he scrutinizes a few. "Wow. Just wow." But gradually something troubles him. He checks another painting. And another. "I'm a bit confused now," he says. "Okay, this requires a small admission, When I was here, with Bear, I did something a bit naughty. One afternoon, I found his keys left in the cottage door. I went to return them to him, but noise was coming from upstairs. She was with a lady friend. So I tiptoed away. I had this keyring in my hand, actually the same one you have, and I found myself sneaking into his studio, which was strictly off-limits. I was just curious, and I saw a bunch of these life stills, which is what's confusing me. Why is that confusing?
He does a web search on her smartphone, bringing up an image that looks identical to the painting before them.
See that? A hedge fund manager bought this picture.
He finds an image of another painting in the kitchen.
Look, this is a Vogue shoot. This painting is in a mansion at St. Petersburg.
After repeating this with several others, he turns to her.
Hate to tell you, Ching. These are copies. It did seem a bit too good to find original Bavinsky's dumped in an attic.
I'm sorry.
Maybe Bear made two of each painting.
Bear hardly kept one of each painting. These are copies, and I'm afraid, not worth a penny. 87. They're famished, so they lock all the doors and drive for lunch to the nearest village, where the only restaurant is a drab pizzeria. They take a table by the door, chewing crusts, a downpour outside, an occasional car whooshing by. Neither says much, yet they've become closer by dint of their shared hope and shared disappointment.
Tired,
she comments. He smiles, nods. When she returns from the toilet, he watches her approach, feeling so fond of Ching for her kindness to his friend. She was terribly in love with Charles, Marsden knows, and is sorry that his friend never let himself fully reciprocate.
The unfinished painting on the easel, did you make out the face?
He asks her.
Charles? I'd need to see it under proper lighting, but I'm pretty sure. Yes. I knew Charles when he was not much older than that. What's odd is, I have no memory of seeing that painting here. Bear did it after you left, maybe.
He died before I left. He wipes his hands on a serviette, pausing, seeing Bear lying on the mountain path.
Come to think of it, that portrait couldn't have been done in the studio. Bear didn't paint the faces here.
Yes, he did.
You're wrong, Ching. I was living here, and they weren't around. But Charles always brought them back from the cottage.
They kept eating, neither tasting now.
I have a scary feeling again, he says. Me also.
They drive fast back up the winding hill. The paintings are untouched, which almost surprises them. Their focus made it seem as if the world were converging here. A cloudburst is over, so they lug the unfinished portrait into the kitchen.
Yes, it's Charles, she acknowledges, as a young man.
Marsden is occupied, studying the reverse sides of various life stills, just smeared with threads of tobacco, and manly handprints. Marsden turns to her, agape.
Holy fucking shit, Ching. These are originals.
What do you mean?
These here. These are real. But you say Bear only does one of each picture.
That's true. Is it possible that the ones people bought, that those are copies?
Is that possible?
He says, flushing from excitement.
And who came out here obsessively, Ching? Who was the only person? So, that is Charles' painting, hanging in St. Petersburg. They all are. I bet you!
He claps, jubilant, but is still jittery, still running through the consequences. Ching walks into the living room, trying to digest this. She pauses at the memorial booklet, its pages paint-spattered, folding at reproductions of family snapshots. These photos are curiously familiar, including one of Birdie at age 15. Ching searches online for images from the Faces series. She starts shouting for Marsden.
Look! Come look!
The Faces paintings aren't identical to the memorial photos, but they were clearly inspired.
I'm telling you,
Marsden says triumphantly.
I saw Bear's late days. The man was terrified to work. He had his trademark style and was resting on it. There are no late works by Bear Bavinsky. The late works of Bear are the early works of Charles. They're his late works, too, Marsden remarks sadly. Well, you're a rich woman, Ching. All those collectors who bought phony Bavinskys might sue the sellers, but That wasn't you. It was his siblings. I guess they might sue the estate. Come to think of it, you'll have lawsuits. Still, in my view, you have every right to put these on the market.
What about the life stills that Charles painted?
Oh, it'll be a huge scandal, Marsden says, delighted. When your originals hit the market, there'll be insanity. What a comedy. Hey, do you think Charles cultivated that pompous journalist, Bear's authorized biographer, to pull this off? To have an expert at the ready to verify all his fakes? Or is that too crafty? Ching, you have no idea the stink this is going to cause. Rubbing his hands with glee, he finds a Cecil Ditchley teapot and a box of loose Darjeeling. At the stove, he tests the gas tank, which still has fuel, and makes them a brew. Ching leans over her steaming cup.
What I do now? You don't tell.
Is that a question? She approaches one of the original life stills, lifts it, and drags it towards the front door. He stands, bemused. Whoa, it's raining outside. Ching? Ching, stop! But she persists, pulling the painting by one side, which causes him to grab for the other side, lest a decades-old masterpiece be dragged along the soggy lawn. He keeps telling her to stop, or at least explain herself. She keeps moving, saying only, "You'll see. You can see now." She back-kicks open the unlocked studio door and drops her side of the canvas on the floor. "This machine? What is it? Fireplace?" She points to the kiln. "How do I turn it on?" "Hang on, Jing. What am I supposed to not say anything about?" "I burn them, all the paintings." Blinking double time, he scrunches his face. "Jing, this is an original. Apologies, I thought you understood. We're talking millions of dollars, each one." "I understood." "Then I don't. If I sell these ones, then the paintings that Charles did all around the world, they come down, and the museums that are putting up the faces, also by Charles, what happens?" "Okay, fine, but you cannot just destroy original works of art. These are the rare few that Bear saved. He kept them back for years and years. They are part of art history. You can't. I'm sorry." "Charles' paintings go in the museums," she insists, kneeling by the kiln, struggling with the latch. "You're not doing this," he repeats. "If you want to honor Charles, remember that he spent years guarding these paintings." "How I can turn on this machine?" "I'm not showing you. Sorry, I won't." 88. Marsden strides fast towards the woods. "This woman is nuts." He scrambles up the subsided remains of his staircase in the hillside, pausing at the beginning of the hiking path. He is panting. His pulse won't slow. The forest rustles. The remains of that old Nokia must be in there somewhere. It could have been his own remains rotting there. "Why," he wonders, "am I so upset with Ching? Because what she's suggesting is a violation. I will not allow it." But why not? I'm supposed to maintain the integrity of art history, as if there weren't thousands of forgeries all through the great museums. He kicks a tree trunk. "Charles," he says, turning to see his friend. "How can you not be here?" On the snowy steps before class in Toronto. "We're smoking Cuban cigars today, my dear Charles. Come admire us and apply your body heat. We're ice cubicles, and it's for you alone to save us." Marsden presses his knuckles hard into his breastbone to drive back the grief. Then he smells smoke and swivels around. It's billowing from the studio. He starts running, nearly losing his footing, skidding to a halt before the oil barrel, which is flaming from kerosene. Ching stands there in the studio doorway, trying to drag out the life still. Marsden blocks her way. "You're not!" She tries to barge past, but he needs only a half step to deflect her. She tumbles, losing her grip on the canvas, which he grabs. She hits the grass, but gasping, winded from the fall. She hurries to her feet, nearly in tears, raising a muddy hand against him as if to ward off violence. "You think I'd hurt you? Never. Ever." He offers his hand. "They're mine. I'm allowed to do this." But he closes the metal lid over the barrel. The flames peter out. He places the life still back in the studio and walks past her, back to the cottage. Before the kitchen table he stands, hands on hips, staring down at these genuine works. He runs his fingers over the rough fibers of the back of a canvas, which is smeared with charcoal, where Bear Bavinsky once wiped his hand. "I'm not," Marsden mumbles. "This is insane." Glancing around the kitchen, he recalls a scene just outside, bear, eyes wide with rage, shouting at his son. You work for me! Get it? You always work for me! And you dare steal? Get this. I win. You hear? I fucking win! Marsden looks at the ceiling, then pushes out the cottage door, striding back through the rain, finger levelled at Ching, who sits in the studio doorway, yet he bypasses her and crouches before the kiln. This, he says, is how you turn it on. She meets his gaze, the briefest confirmation, and drags over the painting. Marsden stands at the far wall, staring fixedly away, telling himself this was Pinch's studio too, wishing he'd asked his friend how you make something of such beauty. Behind Marsden, she grunts from exertion, struggling to fit the large canvas inside. I'm not helping, he tells the wall, then rotates. He takes the painting, stamps on one stretcher beam, which cracks, then does the same to the other side, folding it with ease, cramming canvas and wood inside. We're doing them all? He asks. If you say yes, I might be sick. Together they carry in every other life still, moving in haste, dragging them up the lawn. Side by side they kneel at the kiln, sweat drops splatting onto these last century originals, which Marsden kicks and snaps apart, leaving her to ram them inside. He works fast, needing this to be over. When every life still is inside, he slams the kiln door, locks it. Looking pointedly at her, he says, I did not do this. I didn't too. Through the peephole they watch as the temperature rises, canvases curl, elbows, hips, thighs, they yellow and burst into flames. Smoke rises up the chimney, spiraling over the valley. They return to the kitchen, spent. Ching raises her clunky tea mug, clinks his. To Charles, she says, artist. To Charles, Marsden affirms, voice cracking as he looks to the ceiling, blinking fast. Best of artists. Before leaving the property, Marsden pockets a Cecil Ditchley mug, a token of this place which will never return. The lone object Ching takes home is that unfinished self-portrait of Pinch, pictured as a youth, back when he believed he'd endure, that strangers would know of him some day. Ching keeps that painting under his bed in the spare room. At times she takes it out, never for long, just a look. London, 2018. 89. On the 20th anniversary of Bear Bavinsky's death, the first major retrospective of his work is organized at Tate Modern. Marsden and his longtime partner Rob close their Prince Edward County bed and breakfast for a few days and fly to London. The museum is holding another show too, the Selfie Shtick, auto-fictions of the contemporary canon, where once snarling, now domesticated young British artists have chosen works by their personal friends, including huge plastic dog feces by a Taiwanese sculptor, computer-generated images of a Czech artist known for dressing up as Disney characters, and even a video series by Temple Butterfield. The exhibition has won rave reviews, so Marsden expects everyone to congregate there. But he's wrong. Crowds are trooping into Bear Bavinsky, The Body Politic, with throngs gathered before all of the paintings, which are ranged across 11 rooms. Many visitors take photos, wanting evidence of their proximity to greatness. Others stand, frozen with audio guides, learning about the artist's private life, the opulent childhood in St. Louis, his precocious rebellions and wartime traumas, the fierce debates at Black Mountain College, the scene in Greenwich Village, his travels through bombed-out Europe, years in the critical wilderness, his volatile relationships with women, most notably his third wife, Natalie, now recognized as the painter's muse, demonstrated by her appearance in so many of the Faces series. For context, the curators include a vitrine of 8 ceramics by Natalie, marked courtesy of Chow Ching Fei, whom visitors assume to be a tycoon collector. The first rooms contain Bear Bavinsky juvenilia, childhood sketches drawn in a hospital bed, already showing promise, slapdash portraits from his army days, early experiments with abstraction, his unique style, approaching its consummation in the mature works that dominate subsequent rooms, including a triumphant display of 18 life stills from private collections, plus 14 of the faces which are lent by museums. According to the catalogue, the faces have all entered prominent public collections, owing to the tireless efforts of the Pulitzer-nominated biographer Connor Thomas, who has made it his mission to accomplish the lifelong wish of Bear Bavinsky. The museums didn't pay full valuation, instead covering outstanding taxes and fines earned by the estate. Today, the faces reside in the permanent holdings of the Musée d'Art Moderne in Paris, the Menil Connection in Houston, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach, the Art Gallery of Ontario, Moderna Museet in Stockholm, the Gumenten Museum in The Hague, among others. In the final room, Marsden hesitates by the exit, not willing to leave. Rob is curious to peek into the selfie shtick, so Marsden returns alone to the beginnings of the Bavinsky exhibition, renting an audio guide this time. The narration speaks of Bear as the embodiment of that old slogan, art for art's sake. He toiled for decades without caring what the public thought. He scorned money. He dedicated himself to a singular vision. Why, Marsden wonders, are these myths still recited about artists? It's probably lucky that Charles never became a painter in public. It'd have demolished him. Rather, it'd have ignored him. He lacked the personality, which is so much more important than any audio guide dare say. Instead, this one cites the erotic absence of the life stills, noting that from the 60s onward, a frequent claim against Bavinsky, strenuously denied by the artist, was that he was an ascetic reactionary, and to some, misogynist. But it hastens to add, Bear redeemed himself in the purest way, through art, as shown in the undeniable humanity of his Faces series. Marsden smiled. Bear gains his glory in the end. Though this isn't quite the end. There's 50 years hence, 100, 500, all diminishing towards that everlasting instant when nothing by human hand remains. But today, Bear is triumphant, strangers speaking his name, estimating his prices, dreaming of his objects on their walls. For a minute, the crowd clears. Marsden is alone in the room, standing before Pinch's paintings, Natalie's pots. He urges his eyes to hurry, absorb this, to save this sight. Gradually, other visitors drift in. He takes a last glance around, presses play on the audio guide, and proceeds towards the exit. From these masterpieces, Bear Bavinsky speaks, the narration concludes. Even today, even beyond the grave, from these paintings, truly, we know him. This is Sam Alexander. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Italian Teacher by Tom Rackman. This program was produced and directed by the audiobook producers for Quercus Editions Limited. Text copyright 2018 by Tom Rackman. Production copyright 2018, Quercus Editions Limited. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.